All right, the Health and Human Services Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Pearson moves approval for the minutes of January 25th. Any additions, subtractions, corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails, the minutes are adopted. Excuse me, today we have continuation for the budget. We have the governor's budget before us. We'll have several folks presenting. We will start with Randy Snyder, Executive Director from the Nursing Home Administrators Board. And we will have Cody Weiberg on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please present in whatever order you like and introduce yourself for the record. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Randy Snyder. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Examiners for Nursing Home Administrators and also the Executive for the Minnesota Board of Optometry, and also currently serve as the co-leader, the fiscal agent for the Administrative Services budget. Benha actually only has $200,000, but ASU has significant costs that we collaborate with. You heard from many board partners yesterday, and so I'll direct my comments just to Benha, the Board of Nursing Home Administrators, ASU and Optometry, in a very quick overview. So for the Board of Examiners for Nursing Home Administrators for 2018 and 2019, the board believes it has sufficient fees and spending authority to maintain the same level of effort from its current biennium base budget, and they will not be seeking any modifications or change items for this period. We will be back in 2020-21 budget period to look at potential fees and spending authority at that time. Unique to Benha, we are the only federal required health occupation board in Minnesota. Federal mandate requires that a majority of the board members be comprised of non-licensees. So five of the nine voting members are not administrators, which is a little unique in the state. The board continues to influence leadership in creating quality environments for tomorrow's elder care continuum, and we'll be back in the policy year next year for a statutory change to address the national portability of licensure and a new pathway of licensure called the Health Services Executive, adding to our existing four pathways right now, and that will emerge in the 2018 session. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's really all I intend to provide today because we don't have any change items for the Nursing Home Administrators Board. A significant change will be occurring under the ASU model, and so I'll just do a quick snippet on ASU and let Ms. Vagsness take over from there.
That'd be great.
Okay, sir, thank you. Overall, there are 18 boards that manage ASU, the Administrative Services Unit, of which 15 are health-related licensing and three occupational boards funded with the general fund. We're all co-located together and cooperate in a collaborative fashion with the centralized back office for common business tasks and while keeping the subject matter experts at the various board levels. So nurses are there for nurses, physicians for physicians, that kind of thing. ASU provides the centralized administrative services for those 18 agencies, including budgeting, fiscal analysis, human resources, payment transactions, purchasing, printing, operations, contracts, all those things you'd expect to be common amongst all the health licensing boards and the other three that we provide services for. All health-related licensing boards are special revenue-funded boards, meaning there are no general fund tax dollars. We have to create our own fees to spend or get the spending authority from you fine folks. We are 100% fee-generated, and there are 183 citizens that form our public, are appointed by the governor, and our board members that drive those decisions. And I can speak that they are very involved in those various occupations and have vetted most of these budgets before you previous to this date. So we'll get on to the ASU. The change items that you're about to hear reflect what one small little board like me could not ever achieve unless we had the collaboration of all the boards together. We think it makes good, efficient government, and I thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the Nursing Home Administrator's Report. And I'll now turn it over for the ASU and the change items, and Ms. Julie Bagsness. Are there any questions for Ben Hop?
Any questions, members? Seeing none, please continue.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Julie Vangsis. I'm the accounting director for the Administrative Services Unit. You will find our budget pages within the budget pages for the Board of Nursing Home Examiners. Our purpose and mission is on page 21, and then our change items are starting on page 6. We have several change items, six of them in the governor's budget that we do support. Our first change item is a small agency operating increase. This proposal is to cover a salary increase for our current five staff that operate ASU. It's a $9,000 increase in fiscal year 18 and a $10,000 increase in fiscal year 19. Our second change item is on page 8, and it's a health licensing operating increase. This proposal appropriates funds to the Administrative Services Unit and provides the authority to distribute the funds to the 15 licensing boards to cover the cost of employer-paid health care contributions, pension contributions, the FICA and the Medicare tax, and any other salary changes that would occur. This increase is for $194,000 in fiscal year 18 and $350,000 in fiscal year 19. Our third request is on page 9. It's our IT increase. This request is to cover increased information technology costs. The health-related licensing boards are like phase one of the merge to the Minute Enterprise solutions. This increase will cover the cost of essential IT-related and enterprise LAN services, our enterprise data center, the rate plans, and then just the normal increases that are related to our voice, email, internet, web services. This request is $125,000 in fiscal year 18 and $136,000 in fiscal year 19. Our fourth request is on page 11. It's a combined retirement request. This request covers 17 possible retiring state employees within the health-related licensing boards. This request will cover the cost of the severance pay and vacation payouts for those long-term state employees according to the bargaining units that they're in. Over the past several years, the health boards have combined this retirement expense into one change item instead of coming forward with several change items under each board. There's eight boards that participate in this particular expense. This is a one-time request of $378,000 in fiscal year 18 that can be used for the full biennium. And anything not spent, if we have retirees that change their mind, that funds would be canceled back down to the fund balance. Our fifth request is on page 13, and it's for an accounting officer position. This request is to hire an accounting officer senior who will support the work of the health-related boards and ASU. It will be an added position to our current ASU team. It will provide expert services related to contracting, grant management, reporting services, administrative functions, financial services, and internal controls. The base increase for this is $85,000 in fiscal year 18 and $90,000 in fiscal year 19. And our last proposal is on page 15. It's our Minute IT staff move. This is a shift move of funds. And you heard from a few boards yesterday that currently we have IT staff that are budgeted under ASU, the Board of Social Work, the Board of Marriage and our Medical Practice, and the Board of Nursing. This request will reduce the budgets for the staff within those three boards and move those funds to the budget under ASU so that we could have a merged unit that funds all of our staff that provide the services to the health boards. This is a base budget change. $544,000 in fiscal year 18 and $554,000 in fiscal year 19. This concludes my comments. I thank you for an opportunity to speak today and stand for any questions.
Thank you. Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for testifying today. When you talk about the service consolidation for a minute, if we're simply moving numbers off the books of the sub-boards and moving it over to the ASU board, why would that not be a wash? Their funds come through you?
Ms. Bangsness.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, each of those three boards, their budgets, the amount there would be reduced out of their budget, and that would move then over to the administrative services unit. And so you'll see a negative amount under their budget lines. When we did this, our base budget for those positions hasn't increased for several years, and over that time they've taken different roles in their positions. And so it wasn't an equal wash. We were short about $109,000 that we would be requesting in addition to moving of their base budgets over. So it's really an increase of $109,000. The remainder of that is part of the move from their budget into the ASU budget.
Representative Lewin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on page 11, the pension appropriation for the 17 retirees.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have information as to either a headcount or percentage incidence of when someone retires that we bring them back after retirement at a like a consulting level or an independent contractor level?
Ms. Bangsness.
Mr. Chair, we normally don't bring somebody back. Once they retire, they leave state service, and then we would fill their positions or post their positions depending upon the budget that we have remaining for that year. But we typically don't bring someone back under a post agreement.
Good. Thank you.
All right. Other questions? And Representative Lunan, we do have Minnit here today who's going to be speaking last. So if you have questions about kind of the referring requests within the board, that would be a good time to answer those. Let's see. Anything else?
Mr. Chair, I still have the Board of Optometry that we can do.
Okay,
quick.
Just optometry?
Sure.
All right, let's do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, again, I'm Randy Snyder, Executive Director, now testifying for the Minnesota Board of Optometry. Since 1985, the Board of Optometry has had but one fee increase. Unfortunately, we have fiscally managed their operations without a significant reset to their budget. But we are one of those boards that has to look at increasing our fees and also increasing our appropriation for this core function of the budget in this year. Currently there are 1,095 licensed doctors of optometry in the state of Minnesota. We show a modest increase each year, about 50 and about 20 retirees a year or move out of state. There is no school of optometry in Minnesota and 22 throughout the nation, with the closest being in Chicago. About 75% of the population requires some visual correction to be successful in their daily living. I'll quickly outline the budget and fiscal operations for the Minnesota Board of Optometry. And again, this is a board that takes a lot of participation. It's about $140,000 is all we're dealing with here. But they view every penny when they're looking at it and creating budgets, and they spend many hours in looking at this to get it to this point. The four change items are a small agency operating increase, much like Julia just announced, an increase in expense of rents and salaries and postage and those routine costs there. Information technology, a minute is here today. However, the Board of Optometry was one of those boards that never had a dedicated line item budget. We, outside of the monthly internet and phone connection, we waited until this time of the biennium to buy a new PC. If we had the money, we bought it. If we didn't, we had to wait. But now with the new Minnit model, we find it necessary to identify and to fund the proposed IT expenses. And there are increases to those expenses, the database maintenance contract of $5,000 a year, computer switches and other IT charges. And so that's a monthly increase to about $7,000 a year, which we used to have about $1,000, but now we're in a new model. The board has increased fees just once since 1985, and we do ask an increased fee with an not-to-exceed amount. And currently, the board does not collect enough fees to be sufficient with these new expenditures. The average for a online or for a renewal of license nationally is $212, and even with this proposed change, would be $170. So we're still below average when it comes to our annual fee for renewal, which accounts for about 85% of our overall budget. That's been thoroughly vetted by the board, and they're supportive of that. The final change item for the board is to seek approval to fund what the optometric community calls OE Tracker, or Optometric Education Tracker. This is a national database that collects all the approved CE continuing education documentation required for the Minnesota Board or for the Minnesota optometrist. And during the renewal cycle, it automatically flows into the renewal online database for us. And we have about 98% voluntary participation at this time. Currently, about 68% of all Minnesota optometrists self-enroll in this service. And what the board is considering is for approval, and they pay $20 individually for that. But what the board would like to consider is to pay that for all of the optometrists in the state, and it would only be $15. So we're saving $5, and I know that should take a lot of your time up, but that is what that change item is there for. So at that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, those are our four change items, and we appreciate your work, and thank you very much for your time today. If there are any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Questions? All right. Seeing none, thank you, for that. Next up, we have Cody Weiberg from the Pharmacy Board. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. Just a little bit about the board itself before I get into the line item requests. So the Board of Pharmacy, as you might imagine, regulates the profession of pharmacy, but we're a little bit unique among the boards because we're one of the only boards that also licenses business. Under federal law, states do have to regulate, for example, wholesalers, and so we license drug wholesalers, drug manufacturers, and also we license pharmacies. And we actually license any company that ships drugs into Minnesota, not just those companies that are licensed or located here in Minnesota. So that is a little bit different. Our mission is the same mission as all the other health licensing boards. It's to protect the public. And we do that, again, by regulating those businesses to make sure that they are shipping drugs into the state that are quality drugs that are not adulterated and misbranded. And then we regulate the practice of pharmacy to make sure that qualified people are licensed to have taken appropriate examinations. Like the other boards, we investigate complaints and take disciplinary action when that's necessary. Unlike the other boards, because we license those businesses, we have to go in and do inspections. And so just a little bit about what the board is about. Oh, one last thing is another thing that's a little bit unique, not related to the traditional duties of a health licensing board, is we run the state's prescription monitoring program. This is a program where on a daily basis we collect information on controlled substance prescriptions that are dispensed. We collect information about approximately 7 million controlled substance prescriptions per year, and we make that data available to licensed prescribers and pharmacists so that they can try to improve patient care by looking for individuals who might be potentially abusing those drugs. And we strongly encourage professionals, when they do find someone like that they refer them for appropriate treatment, whether that's chemical dependency treatment or perhaps just better management of chronic pain that they might have. In regards to our budget requests, we are not requesting a fee increase this year. We have three separate change items. The first one is titled Small Agency Operating Increase. It's a total for the upcoming biennium of $150,000. It's related to some increased costs for in-state travel to do those inspections that we do and also to investigate complaints, rent increases, and increase in salaries and benefit costs. We've had to reclassify a couple of our positions to try to retain people. I've lost three people over the last year because they could get paid more if they went out and worked in the private sector. So that is what that increase is about. We have a second increase that is related to information technology services. Actually, a very small proportion of that is related to Minute specifically, and I know they're going to be up here to talk more about that, but that's basically for some of the services that Minute provides, like the telephones, emails, networking, and data storage and things like that. The largest IT request is actually for one of our two vendors. We have two outside vendors. This particular request relates to our licensing vendor. So we have a licensing database that we use to do all the licensing we do. It also does much more than that. It tracks our complaints in our disciplinary cases, continuing education, and that sort of thing. And based on historical precedent, we think that when we renegotiate the contract, we're going to have to up the amount that we pay that vendor. The final change item request we have is related to the prescription monitoring program. That is actually treated separately from all of our other, the other portion of our budget. That is because it is funded not just by the Board of Pharmacy, but it is also funded by the boards that license prescribers. So medical practice, nursing, optometry, podiatric medicine, all help fund that program, so the funds are kept separate. And PMP does pay a portion of our rent. We also, this is one of the positions where we had to upgrade the position to try to attract qualified people. That left a vacant position that we still need to fill. And again, this is our other outside IT vendor that runs the what's called the RX Sentry, which is the prescription monitoring program database, and we believe that we're going to have some increased costs associated with that contract. And with that, I will entertain any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Weiberg. Any questions? Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for coming today, Mr. Weiberg. I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is, as you talked about prescription data,
yes,
is prescription data from a pharmacy released to insurance carriers? And the reason I ask that is, in another life I have, I had talked to an entity called LexisNexis, and they were talking about how healthcare providers track if you are taking all of your medication or you're taking it in a timely manner based on when you renew. So somehow they're getting the data of when people are renewing their prescriptions. Is that permissible?
Mr. Chair, Representative, not from our database. We collect information only on controlled substance prescriptions. There are very specific requirements in the statute that defines who can use that, and it's been very tightly crafted. So only, in fact, not even all prescribers could necessarily look at this database. Prescribers, for example, can only look at this database if the patient is their current patient and if they're considering prescribing a controlled substance, or if they're, for example, in an emergency room and somebody comes in unconscious and they think they might have suffered from a narcotic overdose, they could look at the database. So even the permissible users can only use it for very specific reasons. I'm not sure where providers in terms of physicians might get that sort of data. Pharmacies, of course, have their own data. As they fill prescriptions for their own patients, they retain that data so they can refill prescriptions. So pharmacies often have programs, compliance programs now. If there are physicians that are doing compliance programs, I don't know how they would get that data, quite frankly.
Representative Lunin.
Just a clarification, and it was the, I'm assuming the pharmacies providing the data to the insurance carriers, and what I was told is the research that's being done is they're looking to see if there's a correlation between your credit score and whether or not you take your prescriptions responsibly. I'm assuming later on to have your big data or credit score affect either what coverage you get or what you pay for your coverage. So that's just the feedback I have. So they know when you renew your prescriptions. All right. The other question I have is, you regulate pharmaceutical activities. If I come into fill a prescription, and the medication that I'm prescribed, there is a much more cost-effective generic equivalent of that, is the pharmacy compelled or required to give that information to me, or is that something I have to ask for before I can get it?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Weber.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the current law says that the pharmacy is required to make that generic substitution. There is a little bit of leeway there. So a pharmacist can use his or her professional judgment, and if they think the generic is not safe to interchange, they could potentially do that. That's incredibly rare. Most pharmacists, when the generic becomes available, it's actually in their interest to try to get you to take that generic. It actually is more profitable for pharmacies to do that, too. There is a piece of legislation that I've been working on. It's not a Board of Pharmacy bill, but I helped draft this bill for the people who are bringing it forward. The current language around generic substitution deals with what you might call older-fashioned drugs. And there have been on the market now for 15, 20 years what are called biological products. And the first generics of those are starting to become available. But they're much more complex molecules, so they're not technically considered generics. They're called biosimilars, and they're very expensive drugs. And so the statute needs to be updated so that pharmacists can make substitutions for these biosimilars as well.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Weiberg, I know that I've seen Minnesota ranked with other states in terms of the effectiveness we have in trying to get people to take generics when they should be taking generics, and we do as well or better than anybody else. Is that something that you report on, or do you know if the Department of Health or anybody else reports on that?
Mr. Chair, that's not something that the Board of Pharmacy would report on. What I can tell you, I've kind of kept abreast of this, but I've been with the board for 11 years. The 7 years prior to that, I was the pharmacy program manager for DHS. And at least for the publicly funded programs, Medicaid and Minnesota Healthcare, we took very aggressive steps to try to ensure generic usage. And between when I started there in 1999 and when I left in 2005, the generic usage rate in Medicaid went from 50% to, I think roughly 65%. And I believe right now it's 80 to 90%. So at least in that program, that's what happened. In the general public, I don't actually know that anyone collects that data.
Thank you. Representative Heintzman. Nope. All right. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for what you do. I had a complaint from a constituent just a couple months ago before session, and he wanted me to ask this question. It just occurred to me.
Mm-hmm.
He's on Medicaid, okay, and he was taking a particular prescription that it was necessary for his health. He'd been taking it for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, according to his story, and I didn't check it out with the local pharmacy, he was told Medicaid no longer covered that prescription,
mm-hmm.
and he said, well, I'll pay for it myself. And they said, we can't let you do that.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, that is actually mostly correct. There is a possible way he could pay for it himself. Although patients often don't view it this way, this is actually meant to be a protection of the patient because normally Medicaid providers have to offer services. They have to provide services to Medicaid recipients. There are some medications in Medicaid that require prior authorization. If the prior authorization is rejected, the person has the right to appeal that and to get the drug covered. And one of the worries is that if providers are allowed to simply accept cash, they won't do the work that they need to get it appropriately covered. However, there is a form that can be filled out. And again, I don't work for Medicaid anymore, but I actually recently had a complaint that the board got about this, so I looked into this again. But there's a form that can be filled out either by the patient or their provider that basically what it does is it tells them their rights, and it basically says by signing this form you understand that you have these rights, but you still want to pay the cash for them. The exception is that if somebody is trying to get a controlled substance, which is an abusable drug, then Medicaid will not allow them to pay cash for that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, you know, and again, this was a conversation after a township board meeting by one of the attenders. And he just said he had been getting it for years under his Medicaid program, and now all of a sudden he couldn't get it. And in his opinion, he was going to die if he didn't get it. And I just thought that was off. And so he even offered, he so desperately needed that drug, he thought, that he offered to pay for cash himself, and the druggist refused to accept it. And so what you're saying is he has to do an appeal form that's available, and then he has a chance of hearing back in several weeks when hopefully he's still alive. drug.
So Mr. Chair, Representative Gruenhagen, again, I don't represent DHS anymore, but this very issue, we had an internal debate when I was there, and I had actually taken the position that I would have thought that once we determined that we were not going to cover the drug, either there are certain drugs, for example, federal law just doesn't allow the state to cover, or if we had decided that this is a drug which required prior authorization because there were equally effective drugs but cheaper drugs, and we denied the authorization, my idea was, well, as long as we denied it, then that patient ought to be able to pay cash. But the attorneys at the office said, no, that's not in compliance with the federal Medicaid law and regulations, and they have to have the right to their appeals and that sort of thing. I can't really comment too much more because I just don't represent them anymore. But
just a final comment, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I sell Medicare supplements too. I've got quite a few out there, and with the Part D drug product. And it seems more and more drugs are being taken off by the government or some entity that people have been taking for a long time that have been showing good results, and suddenly they're not covered, and they can't seem to pay cash for them anyway. So I've been selling health insurance and Medicare supplements since 1978, and I just never got these types of complaints before. So it does seem like something has changed rather drastically in that particular area. That's just a final comment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gruenhagen, in terms of Medicare Part D, I don't think that same thing applies. I think people who are on Medicare Part D can pay cash if they would like to. Certainly can't speak for all of the various payers out there. I do know that when I was with Medicaid, and still now, because I do keep in contact with my successors over there, I actually teach an online graduate course in Medicare and Medicaid, so I keep abreast of this. I think what's happening is more and more over the last 20 years, as drug prices have dramatically increased, more and more payers, if they're doing it right, are doing what's called evidence-based medicine. So when I was at DHS is when we started doing that. And just to give you one example, you're probably familiar with Nexium, the purple pill. You see advertised all the time. It's for heartburn and GERD. Back then, those were prescription-only drugs, not over-the-counter drugs like they are now. We were spending a large amount of money. They were often inappropriately prescribed. So what we did is we established prior authorization criteria. We noticed one of those drugs, net of rebates, costs 40% less than all the other ones. We did the clinical research and demonstrated that they were all equivalent drugs. And what we did is we told prescribers they could prescribe all this one drug they wanted without any restrictions. Protonix was its name. The other drugs in that category, they had to get prior authorization. One of the things had to be a trial with Protonix. In the first year, and this is $2002, we saved $3.5 million on that one category of drugs. And we got no complaints. The market share of that particular drug went from 8 to 92%. We had no complaints from patients or prescribers. So if you do it right and you're actually looking at the evidence-based medicine, you can make sure people get the treatment they need, but at a substantially lower cost sometimes.
Thank you. Other questions? Seeing no other questions, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, we have Jennifer Mollenhoff from Marriage and Family Therapy Board. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jennifer Mollenhoff, Director of the Minnesota Board of Marriage and Family Therapy. We regulate the practice of marriage and family therapy in Minnesota. I often hear from people who say they don't even know or did not realize that there is a mental health professional license called marriage and family therapy. Your designation is an LMFT, a licensed marriage and family therapist. It is a mental health profession with the same education and supervised training requirements similar to other mental health professionals, licensed psychologists, licensed professional clinical counselors. You'll see an LMFT providing individual therapy the same as many other mental health professionals, but their focus and training is more specifically on relational or systemic therapy. So you will see an LMFT often offering services to couples and families where two or more members of that relational group are actually present and active participants in the therapy. And you don't see that as often with other types of mental health professions. So it's a little bit more specialized training. We are a seven-member board created by the legislature in 1988, comprised of two public members and five licensed members. We meet six times a year, with many committees meeting about on a monthly basis. As with the other health licensing boards you've heard from, we are entirely fee-supported, receive no general fund dollars. The board currently licenses and regulates approximately 2,500 licensees, and we are funded for 2.5 full-time equivalent staff. As an emerging mental health profession, we've seen significant and steady growth over the last decade, with regulated licensees more than doubling. The budget in front of you today for my board contains four change items for the 18-19 biennium, which you have before you in the governor's budget. I'll quickly run through those. Our first is a small agency operations increase. You'll find that on page 5, $21,000 for the biennium. This is to fully cover increases in salary and benefit costs just for current staff, the 2.5, and pay for increasing board per diem costs and increasing costs related to complaint investigation and handling. Second change item on page 7 is IT services and database maintenance. This is $18,000 for the biennium. This is to cover fixed costs identified to the board by minute, including new annual service contract for our database, required IT hardware replacement, increases in necessary fixed costs like voice, email, web hosting, and the annual fee that the board now pays under its annual service level agreement with Minute. Third change item is new administrative staffing. This is moving our 0.5 FTE to a full-time staff member. This is $63,000 for the biennium. I've been the director of this board for 6 years, and we really have yet to be appropriately staffed. I'm hoping this, when I started in 2010, we were at 1.5, and I'm hoping that 3 FTEs is the right number. So I'm moving that from a part-time to a full-time position. And my last change item found on page 11 is development and training, including board support reach and outreach. It's $41,000 for the biennium. The board has really never had sufficient funding or a sufficient appropriation to engage in meaningful development and training opportunities for our board members or our staff. And equally as important, we lack the staff and funding to engage in even a limited but consistent education and training opportunity for our licensees. Mm-hmm. So I would hope to change that if the funding is granted. The Board of Marriage and Family Therapy has a healthy balance in its special revenue fund. We've experienced strong, steady growth in licensees and the license fees that come with them. We need no fee increase now or in the next biennium to support these budget proposals. But we do need these increases to run this board effectively, better fulfill our mission, and better serve the public and our licensees. And I respectfully ask your support.
All right, thank you. Questions? Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Question about IT. No.
Pass.
Continue with that, Mr. Chairman. just a question about your caseload as far as handling complaints.
Yeah.
I'm assuming the level or the number of complaints must stay relatively consistent from year to year.
Mr. Chair, Representative, one would think that it doesn't necessarily trend that way. We have seen increasing complaint filings in the last 5 years. Calendar year 15 was a statistical anomaly. Our complaints went from, like, on average between 55 and 60 to, I think, we received 90.
For the year?
In 15, but then, like, last year, 16, we were back down to, I think, like, 62. So it's difficult to hold it to kind of a statistical trend line. I oftentimes think I've engaged or tried to engage in more active outreach through our professional association and other things, and I sometimes think that when you talk about the board's, one of the board's primary functions being to handle complaints, I think sometimes that, even though that's always been our, one of our missions, I think when you share that information with broader audiences, that sometimes makes more people aware that, hey, I have a concern, or I do think I experienced potentially problematic conduct, so I'm going to file a complaint. I don't have evidence to back that up, but I wonder sometimes if that's maybe where you see it.
And Representative Lunin.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the consequences, if the complaint pans out to be valid, what are the repercussions to the therapist?
Ms. Molyneux.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the types of disciplinary action a board can take against a licensee are governed by statute. There's a broad range of disciplinary or public actions the board can take, including civil penalty, a reprimand, putting conditions on a license, suspending a license, all the way up to revocation. That's obviously the most significant and serious type of discipline that a board can take against a licensee. But there's a broad range and obviously fact-dependent on as to what type of discipline action is ultimately sought by the board.
All right. Ms. Mollenhoff, if we don't have any other questions on that, that concludes that portion. Do you want to do...
I get to stay up here, yes.
Yep.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am still Jennifer Mollenhoff, but I am now here on behalf of the Executive Director of the Board of Veterinary Medicine, Julia Wilson, who regrets that she is unable to attend this meeting. At least that's what it says here. It says that she regrets being here. And I have a very brief budget presentation, but I really think what she wanted us to get at was cats versus dogs. So should we, like, no, I'm sorry. And if she ever knows,
separated, right?
I think we should move to different sides of the table based on cats. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm the dog guy.
Never.
I'm the dog guy. Dog side.
Is this?
Cat. I have the dog
face. Can't we all just get along? Really? Okay.
You're a horse over here?
I
thought that was a cat.
I want nobody to ever tell Dr. Wilson that I did that. Okay. So,
not on TV. Oh, we are on TV.
We are on TV. That's right. Today. Okay. Okay.
The cat's out of the bag.
Bring it back.
The Board of Veterinary Medicine was created in 1927 to regulate veterinarians who provide health services to animals in Minnesota. Veterinarians fill a wide range of roles in Minnesota, including delivery of veterinary care, research, education, food safety, public health, and other diverse regulatory roles. The board has 7 members, 5 licensed veterinarians with collective professional experience with multiple species, and 2 public members. All board members are appointed by the governor. The full board meets at least 3 times a year, and board committees meet as needed to address board business. The board office is staffed by 2 full-time employees, the executive director, and a full-time state program administrator. At present, the board regulates a total of 2,800-plus veterinarians with active licenses to practice. In addition, the board regulates 473 veterinarians with inactive license status. The most immediate challenges facing the board are a significant increase in the number of complaints being filed and under review, as well as increased in fixed technology costs, including the development and maintenance of a new licensing database. Additionally, the board seeks assistance in paying for increased costs of rent, salaries, supplies, and legal support. The board's fiscal year 16 appropriation was $265,000. That was the same amount appropriated for fiscal year 17. And the vast majority of the board's budget is largely devoted to salaries, office rent, supplies, and equipment. The board has two change items as part of the governor's budget proposal. On page 6 of the Board of Veterinary Medicine's packet is their small agency operations increase. That's $84,000 for the biennium. This is to cover salary and benefit increases for current staff, increased per diem expenses, increased expenses relating to the handling of complaints, as well as specific equipment replacement needs. On page 8, you will see their IT request, $20,000 over the biennium. As you've heard before, it's to cover service level agreement costs, database maintenance contracts, and increase in fixed costs. This concludes my comments on behalf of the Board of Veterinary Medicine, and I'm happy to take your questions or comments back to Dr. Wilson.
Thank you, Ms. Mollenhoff. Appreciate that. And seeing none, thank you for both presentations. We appreciate that today. Next up, we have Roberta. Roberta Opheim. Making her way down. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to share the good news of what I think our office does and provide new members with perhaps a very brief overview. The Office of Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities is an independent state agency that reports directly to the governor's office, and our funds come directly from a general fund appropriation. The word ombudsman is often referred to in various ways in various countries around the world as a protector of the citizen, or a citizen aide, or a citizen watchdog over government. And I like to say we have one foot inside of government, sort of one foot out, listening to the general citizen about what they want and need and feel they haven't received but should be receiving. This is a particularly vulnerable population. We have 9 offices around the state. Most of those are one-man offices where they cover a specific region. The individuals who cover those regions, called regional ombudsmen, and they're required to get to know the counties in their region, how things operate, who are the providers, where to go when you need to assist someone, or to sit on work groups and task forces within those regions that might be helpful. We are non-regulatory, but we do have authority to issue public reports, and I've always been surprised that some people would rather get a fine or a sanction than to read about themselves in the newspaper. The statute requires the ombudsman to promote the highest attainable standards of treatment, competency, efficiency, and justice for citizens receiving services for mental health, developmental disabilities, chemical dependency, and children with emotional disturbance. So most of the clients in the state who would be receiving something for a cognitive mental illness, things that affect the brain, how the brain functions. We have oversight over agencies, facilities, and programs that provide these services, including DHS, Department of Human Services, Department of Health, MDH, Department of Education, MDE, all county social service agencies, and all local school districts, but only serving those who are getting services for one of those disabilities. Therefore, we wouldn't necessarily be oversight of all IEPs, but IEPs of children with emotional disturbance, that type of thing. The services that we provide are outlined in statute. There are a number of different approaches. We have individual cases. We get complaints, inquiries, questions, where someone feels that their rights are being violated or that they've been denied a service they believe that they should qualify for. And we try to facilitate a low-level outcome where everybody can come to agreement or where we can educate the county or the provider. There are over 16,000 providers that we might be required to go into at any given time or requested to go into at any given time. So with our staff allocation of 20, you can see that we are really an ad hoc responder, not a primary responder like a regulatory body would be. We review those cases. Our staff are required to know the laws, the rules, some of the insurance coverage, some of the payment sources, the federal funding, the state funding. We also do death and serious injury reviews. Agencies, facilities, and programs are required to report the death or serious injury of anyone receiving services. We have two people that go through those. Many of them are natural, and so we can close them right away. The more complicated cases we would bring in front of our medical review subcommittee. We have a 15-member advisory board appointed by the governor, of which there are 5 vacancies if anyone wants to apply. And 5 of those members are part of the medical review subcommittee, and they look at these deaths. They comment from their unique clinical perspective. We have a psychiatrist, a internal medicine doc, a psychopharmacologist, a nurse, and Hennepin County's medical examiner are on our committee. So we think we get a pretty broad perspective of what happens to people at the time of death. And what we're looking for is not to sanction or chastise the provider, but perhaps to publish things across the board that we feel the industry can learn from to prevent another serious incident, whether it be a death or a serious injury. We do a lot of what I call systemic monitoring. Our law says monitor quality assurance mechanisms to ensure they work to the benefit of the people they're designed to protect. So we review all maltreatment reports that come out of DHS, MDE, and Department of Health. We, with the advent of 245D, which were some changes in home and community-based waived services, we review all behavioral incident reporting forms, and those might be up to 1,200 a year, and several hundred of the maltreatment investigations. We also serve as a consultant to the federal court and to all the parties in the Jensen Settlement Agreement, trying to move forward with the progress that was agreed to in the Jensen Settlement Agreement. We provide a number of education opportunities for people to learn about either the ombudsman, but one of our biggest systemic systems is the Civil Commitment Training and Resource Center. Well, we will train anyone who requests it on the laws and rules governing civil commitment. We have trained many lawyers, doctors, nurses, social workers, judges have sought training from us, and consumers, their family. That way we feel if everyone knows what the law says, we have a higher chance of it being used appropriately and not, you know, costing the state money for inappropriate uses of the civil commitment system. We tell people what their rights are, and we have been doing that since, I think it's 1997 when we started that. And last year, they added the University of Minnesota Psychiatric Drug Trials. That project is just getting going. My deputy ombudsman, Paul Doyle, is in charge of that, and he has been working closely with the University of Minnesota to what assurances do we need that they've done all their internal controls, and then we will also be prepared to take complaints from subjects of research who feel that maybe something has gone wrong for them or that the program's not listening to them. Our budget, our base budget is approximately $2.4 million per year. 88% to 92% of that goes for salaries. That leaves 10% to 12% for all our other operating expenses, including, you know, rent, paper, pencils, as well as our technology minute services that we receive. On our budget, you will see that we requested the base budget of the agency. We received some funding last year, so we did not make a specific request this year for additional funding, but we are very pleased to see that the governor has recognized that inflation eats away at small agency budgets and continues to deteriorate. We don't have the flexibility of some of the funds that the larger agencies have. So we're glad the governor recognized that and added it, and therefore we'd ask that you support our budget along with the governor's change item. Thank you. If there are any questions, then.
Thank you, Ms. Hoffman. Don't agree with? Questions? All right, seeing none. Thank you.
Thank you.
And next up, we have Minute.
For the record, Jesse Oman, Deputy with Minute.
Anita Scott, Chief Business Technology Officer for the Health Department, Health Licensing Boards, and Veterans Affairs.
So I thought it would make sense, and I'm hoping it's a good grounding for the committee if I start with just kind of an overview of how Minute provides its services. So Minute at a high level is really a hybrid delivery mechanism. What that means is we have some services that we call enterprise that we believe there's an economy of scale, a commonality, or basically out in the industry, it would be considered more of a commodity. These we are consolidating across all the different agencies to be able to get a good economy of scale, to be able to get the best pricing we can, and to deliver it in a very consistent manner. The other side, which we'll usually refer to as local services, are those that are more distinct to each agency and really is specific to their mission and what they might be delivering. These would be the specific applications, maybe a specific database. So those are actually passed through right into the agency's budgets themselves. So basically what they consume, it's directly just a charge back of that amount. Now, these enterprise services, we do charge rates on. So we're able to combine the volume, projecting it forward, combined with the cost of it to be able to come for a per unit cost. Now, some of the changes we've done this year to really help our business partners in their planning is that traditionally these enterprise services would have come out and had that rate package approved July or June, right before that start of that new fiscal year. That obviously created a lot of challenges for our partners for their budget planning. They weren't able to look ahead and really be able to meet with you guys and really lay out what their full budget is. So what we've done this year is we've shifted that all the way back into the September time frame of this past year, as well as shifting it to a two-year rate package with the flat rates across those 2 years, really lining it up with the biennium and with the budget process so that it's better for our business partners to come and say, look, here's what the costs are, here's what we have, and making sure they be transparent with this as they look to move forward. And then, again, from the local side, that would be where Ms. Scott comes into play, where she would be their local IT leader, and that's really sitting down with their business partners and understand what do they want, what do they need, and what's specific to their agency themselves. I'm just hoping that's a good grounding.
Thank you. Ms. Scott, would you like to do any introductory
yes.
remarks? Or?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In general, the requests for increases across the health licensing boards are in four areas. One is, as Deputy Ullman mentioned in the minute, enterprise service areas, which is the rated services that we provide. And that is in the data center migration to the enterprise data center. That is in the enterprise service desk migration that the health licensing boards participated in December and the workstation management support. And in the switch refreshes that are part of the enterprise services. And then lastly, as part of their new e-licensing system that was implemented for many of the boards over the last 2 years. We now have a maintenance and support agreement for the ongoing maintenance of that system, and so that's part of the general increases that you've been seeing over the last couple of days in their budgets.
All right. Now, I just had a general question about Minute. Just in looking at the Health and Human Services budget as well as other budget targets and requests, the policy around interagency agreements as a means of providing contracts versus budgeting, and one of the things that I have had difficulty with is very large interagency contracts that where you might have hundreds of thousands of dollars between one agency and another, where agencies can and do make agreements with each other to spend money or share employees on a temporary basis, versus one agency requesting a specific budget amount and another agency requesting a certain budget amount. One of the things that I'm just uncomfortable with is the creep of the executive authority being able to, in a sense, rewrite budgets through interagency agreements for very large contract amounts. Can you talk about the Minute's position or policy around interagency agreements versus just straight-line budgeting for the agencies?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to the best of my recollection, and I can do another sweep through, but Minute does not use a lot of interagency agreements. Typically, we do have our rates, which are then forecasted at the beginning of the year, so that would be volume-based. And I would say that those are our budgets. We only charge on actual, so it is actually each month where we look at what was the actual consumption. Same with the local budgets, that those are then directly in a FinDep, an accounting system thing that is at that agency itself and is spent for that agency's purpose. Now, I do know of one or two instances where a new technology, as we're trying to decide could it become an enterprise service or not, that a couple agencies could come together and say, hey, we're all willing to start off with sharing a cost of a software purchase. Case in point, I know that we use this around FileNet, which is a document management system. And they may start off with an IA there, but I know even this year in that case, even though we only had three agencies trying out that FileNet, we actually did put it through the rate as well process, so it does have a rate being charged back. That's very much our preferred mechanism, is to either, if we're going to share it, have it rate-based, or have it be specific to that agency rather than trying to manage IAs across a bit. Now, there might be some, and again, I can come back and see if we have any specific that's under Minute ourselves. But generally speaking to your question, we prefer rate-based or that direct pass-through into that actual agency's IT budget.
Now, we've just seen that Minute perhaps being a little bit more entrepreneurial from a policy basis and having a little more interaction with more agencies in more ways that's outside of a traditional budgeting process. So that's just more of something that that I have noticed and one I try to keep an eye on. Other questions? Representative Haley.
Thank you, Chair, and panel. I'm curious, just what is the total size of your staff and your total budget when I see it broken down with all these agencies? And I'd like a perspective then, too, on the total number of departments or people or computer systems that you serve. And I'd like a kind of a discussion around what are best practices in the industry. So size and scope, cost compared to what you serve.
Representative Haley, are you talking for a minute, for total,
mm-hmm.
minute total? Is that something that you can get, Representative Haley?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we can absolutely get that. One of the things that I've done with rate setting process this year, traditionally, MNB has always been kind of the governing that's approved minutes rates. Now, what we've also put in place as an organization, because, Mr. Chair, you're correct, we are a little bit unique, and I like to describe Minute that it is very much a horizontal agency and that we really are an internal IT service provider, and we're really embedded in a lot of these agencies. It is on top of just that MNB approval of our rates, we've also put a governance group, which has a number of agency CFOs on, as well as some of our local CBTOs, that as we're going through this process, we can really lay out our budget to them and say, does this make sense to you? There's another group where we look at and say, what services do you think make sense for us to provide from an enterprise perspective, and what services do you really feel you need to do local and be able to do that? The third checkpoint that we've really added in is then, as our rate package is put together, we've started now sending it out to an external private company to be able to benchmark it, to actually see how are we doing against not only other states, but also private industry as well. All of these to make sure and partially to address exactly what you're talking about. At a high level, and I can get you some more specific details, but Minute is around 2,100 people. It's around, I want to say, $470 million total spend. Again, that's spread out quite a bit across all of different agencies. I know that that number of people is fairly similar to when we were first consolidated in 2011, when we actually pulled everyone together and were able to identify them and bring them together. Cost-wise, the budget has some fluctuation, but honestly, it's not really grown that much. There's some ebb and flow because, again, we charge on consumption. So if they want more, we provide more. If they want less, then we have to ratchet back. I do know that almost 45% of our spend is more partnering with the private industry. Case in point, Minute has a network that spans all of Minnesota that not only executive branch, but you actually have a lot of colleges and universities use that so they can piggyback on it. Over 95% of that network is managed by private industry. It's us really getting those partners together to be able to build that out rather than us trying to build something ourselves from that perspective.
All right. Thank you, Representative, and thank you, Commissioner, for your presentation. Members, we will meet again on Tuesday, January 31st, where we will go into DHS budget books. With that, we are